Welcome to the nonfiction keynote of the 8th Annual Boston Book Festival, The History of Time Travel. Just wondering, has anyone today come here from the future? Anyone here from the past? No? A few, okay. Not too many, I guess I should be relieved. I'm Debbie Porter, I'm the founder and executive director of the Boston Book Festival, and no matter where you come from, I'd like to welcome you today. And I want to thank... Thank you. I want to thank our presenting partner, WBUR 90.9 FM, and especially Tom Ashbrook, who does such a great job, both on the radio and on a point, and for the Boston Book Festival. I would also like to thank this session's sponsors, the James M. and Kathleen D. Stone Foundation and the Plymouth Rock Foundation. They're wonderful friends of the BBF and great supporters. One more quick thing. This afternoon, we are going to announce the winner of this shiny new red Vespa donated to us by Piaggio, and someone is going to win it, and it could be you. We are selling tickets at the merchandise table across the hall in the Gordon Chapel, which is also where James will be signing books after the session. So while you're waiting in line to get your book signed, you can be filling out your raffle ticket. And proceeds go to benefit the Boston Book Festival. Thank you. And now let's not waste any more time and get to the main event. Please join me in welcoming James Glick and Tom Ashbrook.
Thank you, Debbie. Thank you very much. Welcome, James, just off the train from New York.
Thank you, Tom. I'm happy to be here.
Wonderful to have you. First question, can you get us out of this time? I mean, I really need to get out of this time.
You know, I'm hearing,
Is anybody else ready to get out of here? My God. Future, past, I don't care.
Yeah. I heard somebody suggest that wouldn't it be possible to travel back in time and teach a certain future dictator manners? Which I thought was a good variation on the theme of going back in time and killing Hitler, at least a more polite variation.
And now here I sit thinking, which future dictator?
Yeah.
You write about so much. I mean, you've written about chaos and genius and information about Isaac Newton and Richard Feynman. Now you're writing about time. I really love this book. This was just awesome. I wish you'd put us in a time machine right off the bat and take us back to 1895. Would you just read from the very beginning of your book?
A man stands at the end of a drafty corridor, aka the 19th century, and in the flickering light of an oil lamp examines a machine made of nickel and ivory with brass rails and quartz rods, a squat, ugly contraption, somehow out of focus. Not easy for the poor reader to visualize, despite the listing of parts and materials. Our hero fiddles with some screws, adds a drop of oil, and plants himself in the saddle. He grasps a lever with both hands. He is going on a journey. And by the way, so are we. When he throws that lever, time breaks from its moorings. The man is nondescript, almost devoid of features, gray eyes and a pale face and not much else. He lacks even a name. He is just the time traveler, for so it will be convenient to speak of him. Time and travel. No one had thought to join those words before now. And that machine, with its saddle and bars, it's a fantasticated bicycle. The whole thing is the invention of a young enthusiast named Wells, who goes by his initials, HG, because he thinks that sounds more serious than Herbert. His family calls him Bertie. He's trying to be a writer. He's a thoroughly modern man, a believer in socialism, free love, and bicycles.
Thank you. Thank you. James Glick, reading from the beginning of time travel. And very quickly, we're on to this. Nowadays, we voyage through time so easily and well, and so in our dreams, in our art, time travel feels like an ancient tradition rooted in old mythologies, old as gods and dragons. It isn't. Though the ancients imagined immortality and rebirth and lands of the dead, time machines were beyond their ken. Time travel is a fantasy of the modern era. When Wells, in his lamplit room, imagined a time machine, he also invented a new mode of thought. Really?
Really?
I thought that, I mean, what about Scrooge? What about a Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's court? What about, I don't know, didn't Thor or somebody in the Bhagavad Gita move around through?
Yeah, you'd,
hadn't we been
you would
there
think, wouldn't you? This is really the starting point for me, thinking that there was a history to be written of time travel. It was the idea that time travel actually isn't that ancient, because it's such an obvious idea. I mean, it just seems like time travel is no weirder, no more, should be no more obscure than breakfast. You know, it should have been.
To us now.
Well, why shouldn't it have always been there? Why shouldn't cavemen have imagined it?
Bertie Wells.
Well, no,
Yes,
Charles Dickens had, if you want to look for counterexamples.
Okay.
Yeah,
Christmas
there was
past,
the Christmas past, Christmas future, but nobody is actually traveling through time. He is, as the 19th century goes on, and he wasn't long before Wells.
No.
He was starting to think about, well, the past, the future. And of course, people had always thought about the future in a certain way. They would consult fortune tellers and soothsayers and, you know, read tea leaves, literally. And when they were doing that, they were mostly thinking about their own future,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Will I meet a tall, dark stranger sort of thing?
Okay.
And you also mention Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, which is a great example, and it's 5 years before Wells.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a kind of time travel. I mean, you can make the case. His hero, our hero, the Connecticut Yankee, I'm sure you all remember, travels.
Probably have a number in the audience right now.
Of Connecticut Yankees.
Yes.
Of Yankees, anyway. Well, this Yankee, Hank, was a factory engineer. A real can-do guy.
Yeah.
He was a geek. He was up to date with all the latest technology, just as Mark Twain was. Mark Twain was the first guy on his block to have a typewriter and a telephone. He loved all that stuff. And it's not
went broke trying to build fancy technology for printing in those days.
Yeah, and so what's the mechanism of time travel 5 years before H.G. Wells invents a machine? Hank gets whacked on the head in a fight.
Yes.
And then he wakes up, and he's in a field. And there's a town in the distance, and there's a horse with a, you know, fancy blanket. And on the horse, there's a guy wearing armor. And he says, Hartford? and the knight says, Camelot.
Of course.
And we're off. And the engine of Twain's story is kind of part of the argument I'm trying to make about Wells. It's that suddenly people were aware of the difference between the technology that they had and the technology of the past.
They didn't have time traveling technology, but they had suddenly trains and telegraphs. And
exactly. And they were synchronizing clocks using their telegraphs. And so they were thinking about time, and they were also thinking, for the first time, what will the future be like? How will the future be different for my children and grandchildren? What sort of wonders and marvels will the year 2000 bring?
Mm-hmm.
Because it was just 5 years before 1900. In 1900, everybody was very excited. It was the turn of the century. There were celebrations. Looking back, there weren't a lot of celebrations. It wasn't a big deal when the 18th century ended and the 19th century began.
But this time it was because they felt a forward thrust of
exactly.
technology.
People were futurists. They were thinking about the future. And that was H.G. Wells. He was a future guy.
But was he science-oriented? He wrote in here, clearly the time travel proceeded. Any real body must have extension in four directions. It must have length, breadth, thickness, and duration. And you write, the fourth dimension. Was this Bertie Wells being a scientist, or what's going on here?
Right. So this is, for people who don't know, this is the way the time machine begins. It begins with the time traveler giving a little lecture to his friends to set up the story, and he has to justify this impossible idea that you could have a machine that would travel through time. And so the way he does it is to give a sort of, I think to modern ears it sounds fairly pompous and pedantic, a little lecture to his friends.
Link,
yes,
Ritz.
Like that. And he tells them everything that you learned about time is wrong. Time is just another dimension like space. You can imagine it as a direction. And every object has four dimensions, and the fourth dimension is duration. And if it didn't have any duration, it would only exist for an instant. And so we have to imagine it extending into the past and into the future. And so I've made a machine that can zoom along on that track, on that impossible to imagine track.
But there's something different about the palpable, the visceral sort of reality of this. You write, remind us that in Victorian England, his time and preceding him, they had fourth dimension idea was out there, but you say it was served as a catch-all, a hideaway for the mysterious, the unseen, the spiritual. Anything that seemed to be lurking just out of sight, heaven might be in the fourth dimension. Wells takes us where?
Wells, of course, takes us into the future. He is thinking about time as the fourth dimension, and fourth dimension as a thing in geometry is something mathematicians had speculated about. It was obscure, but it was in the air. Wells wasn't inventing it magically. And of course, it was 10 years later that Einstein published his first, at that point obscure, paper in a physics journal on special relativity, in which he is imagining time as exactly that, a fourth dimension. And that's why when, you know, for us, we know time is the fourth dimension, right? Nobody was surprised by that idea. Mm-hmm. Wells's time traveler had to explain it to his pals.
Mm-hmm. Think about it.
And they didn't believe it, and they had to argue about it. If you know, if we're writing the story now, we don't have to bother with all that stuff because we already know it.
You write, in short, surprisingly short order, this notion would become part of the orthodoxy of theoretical physics. He wrote about time travel, but you say not as a scientist so much as he wanted to sell books, and he wanted a good story.
Yeah.
That was his. Throughout this book, wonderful book, there's this tension between the sort of scientific view of this and the poetic or the literary view of time travel. Take us through time travel itself. What were there scientific propositions that were put on the table one after another about whether this could happen and how it might happen over the centuries since?
I should say it's not, well, as you know, it's not really a book about the science.
No, it's not.
Of time travel. It's not.
You sort of just sucked us in. It's like the time travel is the flashy billboard out front. It's time.
If anybody is planning to buy the book, hoping that there will be, you know, an instruction manual at the end.
In the middle there's a whole graph here.
You're bound to be disappointed because there isn't that much science of time travel, but there is some. There are people now, there are physicists now who love to talk about time travel. Wormholes, right? Interstellar, I'm sure a lot of you saw, had, as a producer and scientific advisor, a very serious relativist, Kip Thorne of Caltech. Mm-hmm. It's a sexy idea, even if it's, I would say, impossible. But so my story is really about how the idea develops on parallel tracks, and not just the idea of time travel, but a whole assortment of ways of thinking about time that suddenly became unsettled and thrown up for grabs. And so philosophers were worrying about time, as they always had, but now they were worrying in new ways because they were reading Albert Einstein.
Mm-hmm.
And
he was a schoolboy in Munich when H.G. Wells brought this out in 1895.
That's right. And so soon after, philosophers had to start to deal with ideas of relativity, and it was coming at them from left field. And there were philosophers who also said, well, let's examine this, let's look at this fantasy by H.G. Wells and analyze that philosophically.
What did it disrupt in terms of standing philosophy?
Well, philosophy, before Einstein took over, had a view of time. William James thought a lot about time. Henri Bergson thought about time. These were people who were thinking about the psychology of time, and they were interested in questions that interest all of us still. How do we perceive time? Why is our perception of time so malleable? You know, why does a month seem to stretch on into eternity when we're 6 years old, and it goes by in an eye blink when we're my age. But scientists were not interested so much in the perception of time. They needed time to be a very real thing. And Einstein, on the one hand, was throwing open the doors and forcing us to reevaluate the way we think about time. But on the other hand, he was following in the tradition of Newton and everybody who had come since in making sure that time was mathematical. It was a very real thing. It was to be measured. It wasn't just to be thought of with the fuzzy language that philosophers like to use.
You resist that a lot in here. I feel you coming down heavily on the side of philosophers and poets and the literary.
Maybe not on the side. I like the scientists. You know, I've been writing about physicists all my life.
Yes, I noticed.
But they don't own time any more than the philosophers do, any more than the psychologists do. Our conception of time, I've come to feel, is an assortment of things. It's a hodgepodge of things, and it's influenced by science fiction writers, and it's influenced by literary writers who also were doing something very new in the same era that we're talking about. Marcel Proust was practically a contemporary of Wells.
Mm-hmm.
And his great work that he spent his whole life writing, In Search of Lost Time,
yes,
is about time, and it's about memory, and it's about how narrative reconstructs reality, twists it around. And he creates a theory of memory that has tremendous psychological validity, and psychologists today who think about voluntary versus involuntary memory really are, whether they know it or not, in debt to Proust. And soon after Proust, there was James Joyce and there was Virginia Woolf, and they were focusing on time in completely new ways again and twisting it.
Talk about memory and time and what that dance is.
Well, when you think about it, what is memory?
Is it time travel?
We might have a naive view because we're so familiar with computers these days.
Mm, yeah.
But I think this view may have even predated computers, that memory is a kind of storage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get the sensory input, you put it in there, then you need it and you recall it. But that's not how our minds work. And psychologists know that now, and Proust knew it very well. And philosophers have known it too.
How do they work?
Well, I shouldn't pretend that I'm about to explain the secret of memory, but one thing that I think is clear is that it's an active process, mm-hmm. right? We know that we cannot simply call up at will any memory that's in there, and we also know that memories come to us involuntarily,
mm-hmm.
with Proust when he ate that little cookie,
the Madeleine.
Right? We also know, or we should know, if we think about it, that memory is an active process. Every time we remember something, we are recreating it. We're telling a story again. Mm-hmm. And when we remember it the next time, it might be a little bit different. And we all know that it's possible, at least I think we should know, that it's possible to have vivid memories that mm-hmm. turn out to be false.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because our minds are just what they are, and we don't have perfect control over them because we are our minds. And
are you suggesting that we're traveling through time in this, or that we're creating our sense of time with the narrative of our memories? I mean, you love Borges. You quote him here, Jorge Luis Borges. Here's 1946, and I love this quote. He says, "Time is a river that sweeps me along, but I am the river. It is a tiger that mangles me, but I am the tiger. It is a fire that consumes me, but I am the fire." Is that him talking about our narrative manipulation of
time? I think it is, yes. He thought a lot about time, and as you can see, he loved to speak in riddles and paradoxes, which I believe, as a person who loves fiction, can be a very effective way of getting at reality.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way that competes with the way physicists get at reality, but physicists don't have any better luck when trying to say what time is. So yes, time is a river. Time is a tiger. Time is a fire that consumes us. We use these metaphors all the time, and we know that they're...
But we also, he's saying, I'm also the river.
That's right.
I am also the tiger.
And he was, in a lot of his writing, he was very concerned with this problem of perception and consciousness and memory, and you can ask yourself, how do I know, what's my sense of, what is creating my sense of the difference between the past and the future? Why can't I, as people say, remember the future? Why do I have such a strong sensation that it's now, and what's now is real, and now, I just said that, but that now, a few seconds ago, it's gone, it's floating off somewhere, but where is it? A physicist might like to say, it's just somewhere else in the great four-dimensional space-time continuum, and that my sense that it's gone is an illusion. Mm. A lot of physicists like to talk that way. And my sense that the past is not accessible because it's open, it hasn't happened yet, that might also be an illusion, according to physicists, but not according to science fiction writers, not according to Borges.
We'll go deeper with them. I mean, the great literary minds struggle with this. You quote Nabokov saying, why is it so difficult, so degradingly difficult, to bring the notion of time into mental focus and keep it there for inspection? What an effort, what fumbling, what irritating fatigue. Is he talking about the difficulty of defining what is the present or this whole project of the texture of time and why it's so hard to grasp?
I think both. I think he's talking about here's the thing that we're very familiar with, why don't we understand it? Why, when we focus on it, doesn't it come into focus? That's what he said. And he's in a way echoing Augustine in the 4th century, the 5th century, who has been quoted many times, consciously and unconsciously, in the centuries since. Augustine said, what then is time? If no one asks me, I know perfectly well, but as soon as someone makes me explain it, I don't know. And we all feel that way, I think. And I think that's more than just a quip. You know, I think there's something profound there. He's not just saying it's an illusion to think we know what time is, because when I try to explain it, I discover that I don't know what it is. He's saying the other thing, too. He's saying, even though I can't explain it, I do have a lot of knowledge about time. And I think it's important for us to recognize that. And that's kind of where I go in the book, where I finally break down and start to talk about what time actually is.
Yes.
That's the case I'm trying to make, that even though it's impossible for any of us to say definitively, we actually know a great deal.
You say we've achieved a temporal sentience that our ancestors lacked. What is that? What is the shape of that sentience?
Well, the shape of it is, again, not
firm.
It's not firm. And it's complicated, because our sense of time is built up from all of these different things. We learn some things from physicists, whether we are science students or not.
Though they despair, you quote Stephen Hawking saying that he hosted a party for time travelers, and you quote him saying, I sat there a long time, but no one came.
Right. That's true. He announced, he had an invitation. He said, party for time travelers, but the date was in the past. I didn't notice, I couldn't see because of the lights how many people said they were from the future.
Anybody here from the future?
Right. Okay, nobody's even willing to lie. But so Hawking loves to talk about time travel because it's fun. And he doesn't really think that time travel is possible. And one of his proofs, I'm doing air quotes now, that there's no such thing as time travel is, if there were such a thing as time travel, we would have time travelers from the future in our midst. And I met a guy when I was working on the book. First I met a woman at a cocktail party, and I said I was working on a book about time travel. And she said, oh, you have to meet my boyfriend. He's got a whole theory. And so he came over and he said, well, you know how Hawking says there time travel doesn't exist because there are no time travelers from the future? Well, I know why that is. It's because they're afraid of disease. And so what I think we need to do
is... Are we that diseased?
For them.
Okay.
Well, you know the way explorers go to a new continent and they catch their... Right?
Yeah, they're too smart to come back here.
I mean, you would think that they would have good medical care in the future, but...
There must be romantics in the future. I mean, I want to go back to King Arthur's court, and I'd probably get the plague or something, but I'd still go.
Right. Yeah. And by the way, would you like to go back, or would you like to go forward?
Can I do both?
No.
I just want to get out of here. That's the main thing. Yeah. My aunt was obsessed with, you know, these medieval fairs. And she believed that she was the present-day reincarnation or Constance for manifestation of a 16th-century Belgian bar, like a tavern wench. And she had a heck of a lot of fun at these fairs. But is that time travel?
Yes, it is. I mean, for me, of course, I see time travel everywhere. But yes, we have all of this cosplay. We are able to imagine ourselves into the past, and we are able to imagine ourselves into the future in ways that just seem natural, but people 100 years ago didn't do quite so dexterously, let's say. Uh-huh. Our eyes have been opened, and so, sure, we tell these stories. We know what happens when we meet ourselves in the past, mm-hmm. right? We argue about it. We've gotten pretty adept.
Talk about the science fiction writers. You say that they've achieved, that they're often the ones who give us the most rigorously analyzed approaches to time. I mean, you know, and we know, you got in the movies, you got Back to the Future and all that, but talk about Kingsley Amis, The Alteration, Philip K. Dick, The Man in the High Castle, what they were putting forward.
Oh, those are good. There are two wonderful books that I'm sure you could get somewhere around here. And they're both examples of what we now call alternative history, where you you reimagine the past, what might have been. Another great example is Philip Roth's novel, The Plot Against America, yes. a few years ago, where he imagined what America would be like if the fascists had won in
Nazi Germany
in 1940. Mm-hmm. No, I won't go there.
Get us out of here.
It's valuable for us to do alternative history. It's a great mental exercise, and it can be done more or less rigorously. You know, you can really, if you're a historian, I know historians who really enjoy this exercise of trying to work out, you know, what would have happened if, and that has some use. But it's a new genre of, it's a kind of science fiction. I mean, it was Philip K. Dick imagining what if the Japanese and Germans had won the war and mm-hmm. divided up the U.S., and Kingsley Amis imagining what if the Reformation had never happened, which might be a little obscure for us, but he works it all out.
Is that an examination of time travel, or is that just a, if you arrange dominoes in a different formation, they fall in a different direction?
I think it's an example of our mental dexterity, our ability to do that, our ability to place ourselves easily in the past and in alternative pasts. There's another fantastic book by Kate Atkinson, two books, one after the other, that imagine she's not quite a time traveler, her hero, whose name is Ursula Todd, mm-hmm. but she lives again and again, sometimes trying to kill Hitler.
Like Groundhog Day or different?
Groundhog Day is another beautiful example of what I would call a time travel movie, right? Mm-hmm. He's not really traveling through time. He's more stuck in time.
The weatherman who can never get away.
The weatherman who has to live the same day over and over again until he gets it right.
The DeLorean in Back to the Future, that was huge. You couldn't have done it in 1894 before the time machine.
Right.
What about their perception, the way that movie played Marty and Doc and all the rest?
Yeah. The movie is fun, and it's sort of, the DeLorean is another great device to add to the list of time machines. I mean, there are elevators, there are doors, there are windows.
Sure.
There are holes in the air. But there's something serious to say about that story, and I think really about every time travel story when you think about them. And that is, I mean, what's going on in that story emotionally when you think about it? Here's a teenager, and he reaches a certain age, and he looks at his parents, and a light bulb illuminates. And he thinks, oh, they were teenagers once. Did my dad feel about girls the way I feel? Mm-hmm. could I find out? And the fantasy takes off from there. When you think about it, a lot of time travel stories involve parents or children, meeting children in the future, meeting parents in the past.
Of course, yes, seeing them one more time, yeah. Changing, in that case, the course of things. You quote Ursula Le Guin saying, story is our only boat for sailing on the river of time. And now we seem to be in the heart of your sympathies here. This is really a realm of story as much as physics or anything else.
Yeah.
What's she telling us?
Well, Ursula K. Le Guin is another magnificent writer, could have won the Nobel Prize this year, although I doubt there are too many people in here who are unhappy about the choice of Nobel Prize for literature.
Like a Rolling Stone.
Yeah, okay, don't start singing,
okay.
Tom.
complete unknown.
She's a science fiction writer, and there are a lot of science fiction writers who, interestingly, seldom venture into time travel. She wrote many stories set in the future, but tried to avoid literal time travel, but wrote a wonderful book, The Lathe of Heaven, that involves a dreamer. This is kind of alternative history again, only it's not the past that's changing, it's the future that's changing. Mm-hmm. Whenever he dreams, he wakes up and the world is now a little bit different or a lot different because of what he dreamed. And the horror for him is that he's the only person who's aware of this. And he can't control his dreams. So sometimes terrible things happen. Is that time travel? Kind of.
Technology continues to change our relationship with the present. The past is more and more easy to capture and carry forward with us. Maybe the algorithms out there are predicting for us what we're going to do next, maybe bringing us the future. How do you see technology now? I mean, H.G. Wells had his sort of fancy bicycle with ivory and leather and steampunky kind of time machine. What about all the gizmos we have now and how they're changing our relationship with time?
That's a really good question, and it's something I think about a lot. And I think it's something we all need to keep an eye on and are learning about as we live through it. You know, we live in this instantaneous networked world. Information comes to us at light speed from all around the globe. It comes to us on screens, big screens and little screens, and sometimes several screens simultaneously. And we're getting messages sometimes from the same person in different channels. And then you have to figure out, did this text message saying I'm right around the corner come first, or did this email saying, no, I'm going to meet you at the movie theater come first? And then you have to look at the time stamps, and then the past is mixed up with the future. Meanwhile, we have tremendous access to the past. We know more about the lives of Bach and Beethoven and Mozart and Mahler and Stravinsky than they knew, than any of them knew about their predecessors. We have instant access to all of their music. Mm-hmm. The music from our personal pasts, the music that we loved when we were kids,
remains.
Is as available to us as music from ancient times and from music that's just being recorded yesterday. And it all gets mixed up together. So we're in a kind of eternal present.
You say that there's a philosophy in our society that we should live in the present. That's exactly where we should be. But that doesn't really make sense to you.
No, I've developed doubts about that.
Be here now.
Be here now.
People spend a lot of time trying to do that.
Live in the now. Mm-hmm. We're told, don't waste brain cells agonizing over what might have been.
Or what's coming.
Don't waste brain cells wishing for something you can never have or fearing a future that might happen. Live in the now. Immerse yourself in sensation. I decided that's not how I want to live. That's not that's how plants live. Plants live in the now.
You know that?
I'm pretty sure.
Okay.
What makes us human is that we know a lot about the past now. We are able to imagine the future. I keep using these same hands. We think the future might be there or there or there. Anyway, we can imagine it, and we can mix memory with anticipation, and still enjoy the present, and I think that's good.
We're going to take your questions in just a few minutes here. There's a microphone right here. If you've got a question for James Glick on time travel, bring it right on up. Do you fantasize about it? Do you have a wish list of if you could have three time trips where you'd take off for?
I always thought I wanted to go to the future, and then was a little surprised when it turns out that so many people just have no interest in that and would rather go to the past. I mean, I can imagine going to the past and meeting Isaac Newton. You know, I have some questions for him, but I really would like to see.
Do you want to be there at the moment when he put the knife into his eye?
That wouldn't necessarily be my favorite moment.
Why did he do that again?
We're digressing.
Okay,
But yes, we were talking about that before. It's true that Isaac Newton, believer in experimentation, wanting to figure out whether light was different from pressure or the same as pressure, actually poked a bodkin, as he called it Shakespeareanly, into his eye and
just
then made
little
drawings and mm-hmm. wrote down the funny stuff that he saw. Anyway,
is there an equivalent experiment about time?
What would you do?
I don't know. Throw a knife forward and try and beat it.
You know,
I don't know.
We don't want anybody here going home and starting to play with
knives. No, right.
You didn't let me answer your question. I do want to go to the future. I don't know when. I'm not as thrilled about it as I was a few years ago because the future is, in so many ways, starting to look a little bleak. But I really do wonder what is, I want to go to wherever it is that we turn into the proverbial hive mind, the world brain.
You want that? You're ready for
that? The Borg. Collective. I'm not saying I want it.
Oh, I mean, you want to see it.
I want to see what that's like.
What interests you about it? They'll just plug you in and make you a cipher.
That's exactly what I'm curious about. I'm wondering whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. I'm wondering whether, because I do think it's happening now. We are partly made of silicon. Almost everybody in this room has a device in his or her pocket by which they access all the world's knowledge. And in a few years, it's going to be contact lens or implants. I hope I'm not bringing bad news here. I'm genuinely curious about is the extent to which we will be able to retain our individuality.
And yet, these stories of travel, I mean, it's appropriate, we're at a book festival. What's more effective than a book at the kind of time travel that you're including in time travel, that is letting our minds roam?
Yeah. Well, I think it's fair to say that the best time machines we have are books.
You say we need these stories for history, for mystery, for nostalgia, for hope. Still hopeful from time travel? Let's say yes.
We'll say yes. Look, there are people lined up.
Awesome. Let's take your questions. Yes, please.
Thank you. I wonder how much time-related management techniques are synchronized with this fictional investigation of time travel, because I think of, you know, looking back at some of the management techniques that are, you know, a little over 100 years old, but I also look at the now where we're using data and analytics to understand the past and use that to understand the
future. You mean like for an assembly line or something? Henry Ford with a stopwatch?
Exactly, yes. And I just sort of see the fiction of time travel sort of going along with the use of that in the industrial world.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. It's not something I go into in this book, but it is true that 100 years ago, a little more than 100 years ago, not at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, but closer to our time, people started to get very obsessed with measuring time very precisely in factories and making their workers more efficient. And that is a nightmare, may I say, that continues to this day because we're all too good at clocking one another.
And now we have all of this machine power dedicated to the what ifs and the what's coming next.
Yeah. Yep. We start saying here, time is a measured portion of eternity, and pretty soon you've got a clock on your work on the assembly line. Yes, please.
Thank you very much. So I wonder if you could address the idea of ideas and creativity as a time travel I mean, the idea, that spark in one's imagination that can help to create new technologies, new ways of doing things. Is that time travel when you create something that's going to be used in the future?
I wouldn't go so far as to say that I think that every spark of creativity is a form of time travel. Mm-hmm. I certainly am saying it the other way around, that to think about time, to imagine the past, to imagine the future, we need to be creative. That's a creative act either way.
And what about premonitions? Do they fit in?
Well, premonitions are another kind of time travel fantasy. And there are people who started writing books about time in the early part of the 20th century that were based on their experience of waking up after a dream and discovering then or sometime later that their dream was actually true, and thinking, oh, I have had access to the future, which, of course, I don't believe actually happens.
I think it does.
Okay.
Well, thank you.
Many people do.
You do merit imagination as a kind of, and we imagine the past, we imagine the future.
Yeah.
I don't know how close premonition and imagination lie to one another, yes, sir.
I've heard the story told that when the modern day keyboard was invented, it was designed to actually slow down typers because they would get stuck in the old mechanical typewriter. So today we're still stuck with that keyboard, even though there might be more alternatives that
QWERTY.
Are efficient. Right. So when we think about time and we go through time during the course of a day, for whatever reason, we've divided it into 24 parts per day. And so as you've thought about time, I'm wondering, is there a more effective way to divide up the day? Instead of just 24 parts, would it be 10 or 100? Or did you think at all about that?
Well,
the meaning of an hour.
I am loath to give advice, to give personal advice to anybody. But I would say the most effective and creative thing to do would be not to start dividing the day into regular parts, but to let our obsession with time slip away.
Why? What is the advantage in that?
Because we need a little of everything. We need some balance. We don't always need to be multitasking and working at high speed. We don't always need to be acutely aware of the passing seconds. Sometimes we need to let our minds drift. I mean, that's what we do when we read a book, right?
Yeah. I mean, does that change reality? You go all the way back to 1814, where they talked about what they called the universe rigid. The effect of its past and the cause of its future, as if all these things in sequence necessitated the next, and everything was in a logical kind of firm chain, unbreakable.
Yeah, and there are still physicists who like to think that way, as though everything is determined by the laws of physics. I think we know better.
You're right, the universe rigid is a prison. Only the time traveler can call himself free. Sir, thank you.
I don't know if you mentioned in the book, but my favorite time travel story is A Sound of Thunder by Ray Bradbury. And I wonder if you could comment on it, especially because it rubs up against chaos theory, which you've also written
about. Will you tell us the central premise for those like me who haven't read that one?
Sure, I can tell you.
Oh, good.
Yeah. No, I mean, my basic nightmare, by the way, is that people are going to mention their favorite time travel story or movie or TV show, and the odds are that it's not described in my book, but in this case, bingo.
Jackpot.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, so the Sound of Thunder by Ray Bradbury is a terrific story. I'm sure a lot of people here know it. It involves a sort of time-traveling safari operation. Safari.
Safari. Mm-hmm.
Safari, where for money, big game hunters who are tired of elephants and lions can go back into the past and shoot dinosaurs. You know, I imagine these as the Eric Trumps of their time.
Awesome.
And not to spoil the story totally, the twist is that somebody steps on a butterfly, goes off the path, and just stepping on this butterfly changes the course of history so that some terrible stuff happens in the present. And this is before, this this Ray Bradbury story is before chaos theorists invented the notion of the butterfly effect, which is based on the same premise. But it also raises yet another of these issues that come up when you're doing time travel stories, that the science fiction writers were the first ones to have to deal with logically. You ask yourself, if you go into the past, first of all, would you be able to interact with it, or would you just be a sort of free-floating consciousness? And then, if you can interact with it, can you change things? And then if you do change things, and this is a more sophisticated question, but it's one that the science fiction writers got to first, if you bump, you know, if there are perturbations in history, would history tend to get back onto its natural track, or would it get into wild divergences so that stepping on the butterfly would mess everything up? Don't expect me to give you the answer.
Okay. We're on the edge of our seats.
No, you can take your pick. That's the point. The science fiction writers, you know, you can pick Isaac Asimov's The End of Eternity, which very clearly expresses the former view that, yes, you can mess things up, but mostly history tries to right itself and get back onto a path.
Or maybe we all have our own version. You quote Charles Lamb back in 1817, your now is not my now. And again, your then is not mine then, but my now, maybe your then, and vice versa. Whose head is competent to these things? Of yours.
I'm really glad you mentioned Eric Trump, because as we've been talking...
Oh, I meant not to do that. I'm sorry.
As we keep talking, I keep thinking about this desire that people seem to have, a certain element of the country seems to have, for a return to the past. This kind of make America great again. The idea that maybe the Trump train is a vehicle for time travel, at least as applied in the political realm. Mm-hmm. Have you thought at all about sort of the notion how politics is affected by the ideas of time travel in our culture? Does your book touch on that?
Honestly, there's. I don't think there's any politics in my book. I do think about nostalgia, and you can think about nostalgia without having to discuss its political consequences. You know, nostalgia is another kind of mental time travel. It's another way in which we imagine the past, and sometimes our imagination misleads us. We're overly creative. And nostalgia works both ways. You know, you can remember the past and make it out to be rosy-colored, or you can imagine the past and make it out to be more dire than it was, and it could be a matter of personality.
Do you feel it's happening now?
No, I'm not going to. I've said enough about the current election.
Fair enough, thank you.
Thank you, it's a good question, though. Thank you very much. Yes, please.
So, from the earliest recording evidence of humans, there's issues of spirituality and religion that are recorded, and it seems like it's something that humans have always needed to do to sort of make sense of their present in terms of a larger picture, and maybe explain their current problems and concerns in terms of relief, you know, from this larger system. And as during the course of the conversation this afternoon, it struck me that time travel sounds like a rational, mechanized response to this ancient human need. I mean, in a way, you can modify or get away from your current needs by going to the future, or going to the past, making changes, or just getting away from what you're in the middle of right now. In your research and writing, did you rub up against ideas like that at all? Is that in there?
What I would say is many religions, maybe every religion, when they construct a spiritual view of time, when they try to think about time, it's common in religion to think about being outside of time. Eternity, whatever it means to you, is not just a length of time, an infinitude, it's also a way of being outside of time. When the ancient Egyptians, when the pharaohs, buried themselves in order to preserve their bodies, they weren't so much thinking about the future. I mean, they certainly weren't thinking about being dug up by people in the 19th and 20th centuries. They were thinking about another world that was outside of time. And I think a lot of religions, when they imagine something like heaven, are again thinking about timelessness. So maybe this is the thrust of your question. Both spirituality and time travel are a way of escaping from something that otherwise is has us in its grasp.
I mean, you say that anyone who thinks about time travel is ultimately thinking about death and escaping death.
I did eventually arrive at that unhappy conclusion in a way that's what time is.
I was thinking
for
just
us.
A good time, like a party. Yeah. And
well, I mean, it's fun to go back in the DeLorean, but really, I do feel that lurking in the background of every time travel story, and sometimes in the foreground, is a desire for immortality. Because what does time do? Time buries us.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. And I'm looking forward to reading the book, even if the answer is no to my question, because I don't have the index yet. But do you talk about or delve into George Kubler? He wrote a book called The Shape of Time, for kind of alternative trajectories to think through art history and visual art and production like that? No.
You've run us off the map.
I'm
give
sorry.
Us, give us a short.
You,
what,
you've
what
got me.
What's his idea?
He's a kind of a pre-Columbian art historian.
Expert.
And he's thinking through, you know, alternatives to the Western canon and different ways of looking through art history that aren't about iconography, but actually are really think about form. And he starts off by talking about how all tools are works of art and kind of tries to adjust, you know, what's on the what the hierarchy is of art history, as well as the record of human production.
I love it. Again, alternate ways of looking at time or history.
Yeah. So a Yale University art historian, 1968. I think.
Kubler.
Good. A-U-V-L-E-R.
Okay, thank you very much. Yes, and another. Are you from the past, future, or present?
Present.
All right, then. it's fine.
So I'm a junior in high school, and we were having a conversation in English class about how authors use their writing from the past to communicate with people from the future, or to sort of live on through their writing. So I was wondering if you touched upon anything like that in your book.
I think that's a really good question. I think people who write books, people who do any kind of creative art that is meant to last, must be thinking in some way about the future, about posterity. When you write something down, it's a way of sending a message to the future. People might not have expressed it that way hundreds of years ago. It might be that your more immediate impulse is to send a message to people in the present, you know. But we do think about posterity, and the question of sending messages to the future is something that we are sometimes more conscious of and sometimes less conscious of. You know, so another thing I write about at some length in the book is the phenomenon of people burying time capsules. Which became very popular about 50 years ago, maybe a little more. And there's a way of sending a message to the future and saying, here's what we were like, here's what our culture was like. I'm going to assemble a bunch of objects and books and magazines and artifacts and bury them in a capsule so that somebody who's curious 100 years from now will dig them up and say, aha.
You're a junior in high school. We love that you brought your question. Thank you. I wonder if there's a different perception of time by age. You quote John Banville here saying, being young, I was skeptical of the future and saw it as a matter of potential only, a state of things that might or might not arise and probably never would. Have you found yourself or observed others more or less interested in time travel, texture of time with a different portion or stage of life? Maybe the young just don't need to care.
No, I think certainly the interest in time travel starts earlier and earlier.
Yeah.
I don't have any sense that either the young or the old.
Young Bernie H.G. was into it.
Are more obsessed with time.
Mm-hmm. Sir?
So Planet of the Apes.
Yeah.
Shoot out, come back, approaching the speed of light, sort of sounds like the Einstein's way of explaining it, right? I mean, we spend, I don't know how many millions of dollars sending out frequencies at the, I think at the frequency of hydrogen with messages that we're sending out to the universe, which they may be receiving 10,000 years from now, right? Are we not looking at the past and the future at the same time?
We're looking at the past, yes. When we look at stars, we are looking at the past of those stars. And that's an idea that people recognized even before Einstein. As soon as, you know, I hope I don't mess up the history too much here, but it was in the middle of the 19th century that people established not only that light has a finite speed, but exactly what that speed was. Maxwell did that in establishing electromagnetism. He actually determined the speed of light. And so immediately, a few smart people recognized that that meant that light that was coming to us from very far away in distance was also coming to us from very far away in time. Right. And that's why we measure distance in terms of light years. I don't think we can see into the future.
Yes, just a couple more.
Hi. So in the beginning of your talk, you started out mentioning H.G. Wells in 1895 and how he was a futurist, thinking about future times. I'm wondering about Darwin and how, by that point, evolution was more or less in the popular consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And also, there were a lot of explorers digging up bones in other countries, and you know, the age of exploration was big, and so thinking about the past was definitely kind of a newer thing and pretty vivid in the popular imagination. So I wonder if you touch on that as well, and whether kind of the urge to think about how do humans fit in the past, maybe was that part of what influenced H.G. Wells, as well as thinking about the future?
Absolutely. That's exactly right. And I've really only given a sketchy view of the things that made it possible finally in 1895 for H.G. Wells to invent this wacky idea. You're right that Darwin was part of it. And H.G. Wells, as a student, studied Darwin and also Lyell, who was creating a new sense of geology that involved visualizing ancient ages of the past buried in rock.
Strata.
And as you suggested, archaeology was also a new thing. People were digging up ancient civilizations, and really, for our sense of how old the Earth was had changed dramatically. It was no longer 6,000 years old.
Forgive me, but I want to end with a reading from this wonderful book. Would you be kind of just read this paragraph for us? Next to the last there.
Okay. Live in the now, certain sages advise. They mean focus. Immerse yourself in your sensory experience. Bask in the incoming sunshine without the shadows of regret or expectation. But why should we toss away our hard-won insight into time's possibilities and paradoxes? We lose ourselves that way. What more terrifying revelation can there be than that it is the present moment, wrote Virginia Woolf? That we survive the shock at all is only possible because the past shelters us on one side, the future on another. Our entry into the past and the future, fitful and fleeting though it may be, makes us human.
James Glick, Time Travel, A History.
Thank
James,
you.
Thank you very much. Well, wonderful to have you here. Wonderful to have you here. The book will be available with James Glick at the back of the hall. Thank you very much for being here today. Thank you for coming. Thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of the festival.
Okay.
Thank you, Jim.
Well, thank you. That was great.